When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code RIOT at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere.
This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 89. We're recording on Friday, January 16th. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I'm here with Jeff O'Neill, and we are coming to you from bookriot.com.
Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm okay. We've had a bit of a trying week, you know, both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, just a couple, nothing bad, really, just a lot going on, and it's a Friday, and it's cold, and we're trying to keep it together here, but I'm glad to be on a Friday. This is a good way to put a little cherry on the week.
Coffee's flowing.
So we've got follow-up to do.
We do.
I know everyone's going to be shocked that there's follow-up to the Facebook Zuckerberg. It's not a Facebook book club. I guess I need to be clear about that.
It's the Mark Zuckerberg.
Zuckerberg's book club. So that's one where, you know, we're going to sort of pay attention to this. But
well, and the people were fairly warned. We warned the people last week that we would talk about Zuckerberg's book club probably throughout the whole year as there is news.
Mm-hmm.
And there is news now.
Yeah. So I just dropped a little. There was the publisher did some stats, and we talked about the early moving up of lists and things like that on Amazon. That The End of Power, I believe, is the name of the book. Got, and the publisher came out and said they actually have data, and in the few days after, had sold 13,000 copies of the book. So that's not even an order of magnitude less. I mean, it's more than an order of magnitude less than what Oprah was moving at her prime, and maybe even moves now. Though I went back and looked for like what current circulation bump according to Oprah's 2.0 book club does, and I wasn't able to find anything. It's all old stuff. So I don't think it's in that million range that we talked about last night currently. I think that's what it once was. But I'm sure it still does more than 13,000. So not quite the bump you would think. Maybe as this thing gets moving and whatever. But
it was, you know, it moved the book from the rank of 45,140th up to being in Amazon's top 10, which is an interesting thing to know about how Amazon's algorithms and ranking work. I mean, 13,000 is still a really good week, especially for a not new book. The Oprah comparisons, I think, were inevitable, but also not
Entirely and unfair.
Yes, and not entirely accurate. I'm not sure that Zuckerberg is trying to do the same thing that Oprah was trying to do. And Oprah was picking, you know, I think intentionally picking books with that were maybe under-recognized before she started talking about them, but that would have wide appeal. And Zuckerberg's target audience is different than sort of the every man and woman that Oprah.
Well, and this is really just tossed off, as far as I can tell. Like, you know, it's something you could do in 10 minutes. Like, Oprah was producing shows, and their author was on there. Like, this is Zuckerberg, like, I'll start a page.
Yeah,
like, and I'll put two posts right here, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, we know how surprise projects begin on the internet, where you're like, you know, it's like 1 a.m, and you're like, I'm going to do this thing and start a Tumblr for it, and maybe I'll tell a few people.
Yes.
And the Zuckerberg Book Club feels kind of like that, exactly what you're saying, of like, I'm going to read some books, and I guess I'll make a Facebook page for it, and we'll see what happens.
And that's just what happens when you have 30 million followers on Facebook. You can just, like, magically make a 500,000 likes appear.
Yeah, and the interesting part of the follow-up is he's doing one book every 2 weeks, which is a pretty fast reading pace for the average American who reads books. Like, reading 10 books a year or more is considered to be like a heavy, active reader in most surveys of the general population. So to plan for 24 books in a year, that's a pretty speedy pace. And so they planned a Facebook Q&A earlier this week with the author, and like, basically nobody showed up for it.
Yep. And 56 comments.
And the Facebook page for the discussion, as we were looking at it last week, it really is just like there's one thread that's mm-hmm. open. They put a post up on the Year in Books page of like, hey, now talk about this book. And it's just one long thread of comments mixed in with it's the mixture of like all the weird behaviors people do on Facebook and all the weird behaviors people do in the bookish internet of like, let me pitch you my book. Let me complain about mm-hmm. Amazon. Let me complain about how much books cost. Stuff that's completely irrelevant to the conversation. So Zuckerberg is really getting to see, you know, the upside of the tool that he's created, which is that you can effectively make a book club that you invite 30 million people to, but also the downside of when you invite the internet, what you get is the internet.
Mm-hmm. Also last time I remember when we were talking about it, how many likes it had. It had 225 and change. Mm-hmm. And we were like, you know, what's it going to do? And over the last week, it's only added 25,000 likes, which
for,
you know, a mortal website, like if we did 25,000 new likes in a week, it wouldn't be a game changer. We'd be like, geez, that's a great week.
Yeah, we'd feel like wizards that week.
But it also hasn't been where it doubled in a week. You know, Right. It's, you know, for something that's actually pretty new. So I think I'm going to downgrade DEF CON Zuckerberg from like 2 to like 3. Because remember, okay. DEF CON 1 is when you're at war.
Right.
So that's the highest DEF CON level, even though they named it. You know, whatever.
How did we get here?
I'm just saying it's counterintuitive, I think, that DEF CON 1 is the highest level.
We're just downgrading.
But yeah. So I'm like, you know, it's a 3 or a 4. It's not even, I started out at a 2.
Yeah, it's...
But now I'm saying 3.5.
The sales for the second, third, and fourth selections are going to be really telling, I think. Mm-hmm. I expect to see about the same kind of response and behavior on the Facebook page, because Facebook is consistent that way, and the way people use Facebook is pretty consistent. But, you know, I wonder if he'll actually stick it out. Like, if he gets to the end of March and the sales for each selection are slowly declining and the participation is not really there. If you're Mark Zuckerberg,
participation.
Do you leave the thing up and just like soldier on because you said you were going to do it for a year and do it and just let it look as like sad as it is? Or do you pull the plug on it? Like, I mean, I think both of us would pull the plug where we have the tendency
or try to find some mechanism to make it not as
to make
crappy.
It work better. But I'm really interested in whether he'll acknowledge it if it doesn't go well.
Yeah, that is interesting. So that's something we're going to watch. And in a week, I feel like my interest in it has changed remarkably just mm-hmm. from what we've seen so far. All right, let's do our first sponsor. Squarespace is back. Squarespace, the all-in-one platform, makes it easy to design a beautiful, interactive, responsive website. We all know. Well, no, we may not all know. If you're my age or Rebecca, who is about 25 years younger than I am, and you've been on the internet for a while, you know how hard it used to be to build a website that looks great, that's easy to update, and that people can use on whatever device or browser they're trying to use. It used to be so hard just to get simple things like, you know, photos to align, or for your spacing in your body of your blog post to look right, or to find a good font that you like. And that's what really Squarespace is trying to make easy, and they do make easy, where you can, if someone without much of any technical knowledge whatsoever can go in and play with their design. What you see is what you get design tools, where you can see your website change as you're making changes to it. You can drag things around, move sliders left and right. So it's very intuitive way, hands-on way to make a website good. I was, you know, as I do when I have an idea for something, I wanted to like see what it would look like as a website. And I signed up for a new trial account with Squarespace. You don't have to enter a credit card. You get 2 weeks and you can play with the tools. And I kind of use it kind of as a design space because I don't have a native like website builder I can just go into. So I use Squarespace's design template layout builder just to give myself some ideas of what something might look like. So some of it might be you don't even have an idea for what your website should look like, but you go and pick out, they've got a bunch of ready-made templates that look great out of the box, but then you can customize them yourself. You don't want it to be brown. You want it to be gray. You want a slightly different font. You want the pieces on the screen. Maybe with a blog roll here and a gallery here, or different kinds of pages internally, you can change the hierarchy. Maybe let's say you have a store of some kind and you want to have a blog and a gallery and a contact us. You can decide which of those things you want it to be when you land on Jeff's Burrito Emporium.net.
You know, I want to go to there.
Do you want the blog to be the homepage? Do you want it to be the gallery to be the thing that's there? And you can change it. So you don't like what results you're getting or what people are asking you. You can switch it from the blog to the contact page. And that's one thing that's really nice is you can change the hierarchy and experiment with different layouts and structures as you go. There's 24/7 support chat that's live. These are human beings. So that if you do run into a problem and, you know, the web is complicated and you might want to do something you don't know how to do, or there may be functionality in Squarespace that you want to use but you don't know where it is, 24/7 live chat. That's something they really are committed to make it easier, because as great as the tool is, the web is still hard. It's only $8 a month. And if you buy an account for a year, you know, sign up for your year subscription, you get a free domain. So Jeff's Burrito Emporium.net, I don't know if that's available or not, but if I were building that website and I signed up for a year, I would get that included. I wouldn't have to go to a third party to register a domain. And some of them are super aggressive and super scammy. And some of them also run Super Bowl ads. But anyway, this is the way to make a super easy and beautiful site. Like, it's not going to look easy, right? It's not going to look like something easy, like if you went did a .blogspot account, like something like that, where, you know, people get, oh, that's what an easy, just sort of bare minimum of effort. Well, if you do bare minimum plus effort, just like a little bit more than bare minimum with Squarespace, you're going to get something that looks categorically better than what you're going to get anywhere else. So go to Squarespace 7. And Squarespace 7 is their new core feature set. It includes images and a bunch of commerce and a bunch of other types of things. Go squarespace.com/7 to read about there. But if you go to sign up, you don't need a credit card, and you can muck around with it. And if you decide it's not for you, don't do it, and you won't have to like remember to end your billing or anything like that. You can go and use the offer code RIOT, R-I-O-T, and it'll get you 10% off your first purchase. Shows the support for the podcast, gets you a little discount, tells them you came from us, so they'll keep buying these ads that you have to hear all the time to help you out build a website. Thanks so much to Squarespace for sponsoring the show, and here we go.
We need to toot our own horns for a minute.
Yeah, we do. We got horn tooting on the agenda.
I bet it's a two-part tooting today. The first thing to shout out, as we teased last week, we're doing our first event, Book Riot Live,
yes,
which is November 7th and 8th in New York City. There are full details about it now on the website, and we'll drop the link to that announcement.
Bookriot.com/category/podcast if you don't want to go find the show notes. It's not an elegant URL right now.
Yeah.
We're going to clean that up, but bookriot.com/category/podcast, and you can find the information there.
Yeah. And so the show notes will be there. You'll be able to click and find out. And there is a mailing list in the post that announces Book Riot Live where you can sign up to get more information, because the website that's like the subsite for Book Riot Live will be launching in a few weeks, and ticket sales will be launching as well. And the first batch of tickets will be at a significant discount.
Yeah, you're going to get a good deal for our fans, for the hardcore
early
fans.
Bird, hardcore Riot fans want to make that worth your while. So keep an eye out for that. And also just want to call your attention to a new series that our buddy Amanda Nelson, who's the managing editor of Book Riot, is writing with Swapna Krishna and Preeti Cheever, who have been, all of them and all of us have been talking about and writing about diversity for the last couple of years on Book Riot very pointedly. And we've noticed that we get the same comments and questions over and over and over. And sometimes it can be maddening and frustrating, but the commonality of those things sort of raised their spidey senses that there was something to do here. So Amanda, Swapna, and Preeti are doing an FAQ series where in each post, the three of them will take one or two of the common questions or comments that we get about issues related to reading diversely and break down what they really mean by those things and why we think about them in the way that we do at Book Riot, why we think it's important, what we want readers to understand about it. And the first one in that series is live now, talking about things like, isn't it racist if you pay attention to an author's race? And they're, you know, I'm very proud of the work that they've done there. I think it's good, important work that they're doing in the series. And it's a thorough, thoughtful, really well done first entry, and something that, you know, as a reader, I'm looking forward to following, but as one of their colleagues, just makes me really excited about seeing it come out.
Yeah, it's going to be a good series, and we'll put the link in the show notes there. And it speaks for itself. I don't think we have much else to say about it other than take a look at that.
Yeah, they don't need any further explanation.
One thing we are going to talk about, because this is, you know, this is one of my favorite's wrong, but this is something even before doing Book Riot, I would have read an article like this. And this is the best-selling books of 2014 that Publishers Weekly put together per Nielsen's Book Scan, which I think we've talked on the show before about the relative uses and drawbacks of Book Scan. They say they capture about 80% of print book sales in the U.S., which I guess is everything. I was doing the math, and I guess that's everything but Amazon, as far as I can tell, because I know Amazon doesn't report to that, or at least that's my understanding, is Amazon doesn't report to Book Scan. Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. I would be shocked if it was true that they did.
Yeah, I'd be really surprised. They're so secretive with their numbers.
And Amazon, if I remember right, has something like 30%. How can that be? I thought they had about 30% of print book sales. Anyway, it's not the upshot is that Book Scan isn't the final word. Like, this is actually the whole thing. They say about 80%, which, you know, classic business PR type stuff. I'd suggest that there's probably that's a fudging of some kind, but it's the best number we have. That's the thing to say. But there are potential problems with it. And Publishers Weekly released the top 10 best-selling titles in a variety of categories. You haven't looked at this.
I have not. I saw the headline, so I know the number one.
So I'm just going to tell you the categories we have, and you can tell me which one you're most interested in. There's top 10 print, top 10 Amazon Kindle bestsellers.
Okay.
Best-selling adult fiction.
All right.
Okay.
So the top print covers all the categories
all
of
the
adult
categories,
and children's
all
and
children's,
all that.
Not, but not nonfiction.
But not, okay.
No, it does cover nonfiction. I'm sorry.
So it's everything, all
and
books.
And then Nielsen, the adult nonfiction top 20.
Okay.
And then juvenile, which is children's young adult. And that's it. So should we start with the best picture category, which is overall print?
Let's start with best picture.
There are no adult novels that were published in 2014 on the 2014 bestseller list.
Okay.
Zero. There is one adult fiction book on the top 10 list.
But it wasn't published in 2014.
But it wasn't published in 2014. Can you pick it out? You got to guess.
Oh.
You're going to kill yourself.
No. I'm thinking. Yeah. Okay, so it's not 50 Shades of Grey because that time has passed. Gone Girl?
There it is right there.
Really?
Gone Girl, number 7.
Okay.
Print
no,
bestseller.
Number 7. Okay, that's
bestseller.
Interesting. And that's the only adult fiction
only
title?
Only adult fiction title on the list of the top 10 print bestsellers. Any guess on the number? For Gone Girl.
Oh, I'm terrible at that game.
That's why it's fun.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so this is the total number it sold in 2014.
Print. And remember, it's 80%. So whatever number you think it sold, deduct by 20%, you're going to be bang on.
Okay, all right. 750,000?
That's a very good guess. It's 962,797.
Okay.
So just shy of a million copies for Gone
Okay,
Girl.
Well, that's a good year for her. Good
that
job,
seems,
Gillian.
I mean, the movie, right? I mean,
yes, yeah.
It's been selling well, but we also had a movie that a lot of people talked about.
And that makes sense. And I did see the headline of this piece was about how The Fault in Our Stars was the number one.
Okay, so there you know it's number one, but then you want to guess what its sales were. And it's the trade paper for Fault of Ourselves, the number one overall seller.
That's such a huge book. Okay, I think it was at least twice as many as Gone Girl.
Yeah, you're right there. It's 1.8.
Oh, okay, so pretty much twice as many.
Yes, but number 8 and 9 on the list are also Fault in Our Stars. The movie tie-in hardcover, the movie tie-in version and the hardcover.
I hate it that they do that.
I know. You wish some human would think to rationalize the list and say Fault in Our Stars all. But I understand, I mean, whatever. It is. They have different ISBNs, whatever.
If you add in all the different covers of the Fault in Our Stars, how many does
three
it total?
3 on the top 10. And basically together, the movie tie-in and the hardcover sold about as many as the trade paper. So we're looking at 3.5 million.
Whoa!
print copies of Fault in Our Stars in 2014.
Like almost four times as much as Gone Girl.
Just an enormous, enormous
that
number.
That is bonkers, man. Never underestimate the power of the YA audience.
The green can sell. And we're going to continue on the YA because I'll go through the rest of the list.
Okay.
Veronica Roth, all three of the Divergent series are on the top 10.
The ones that we can never keep in order.
Divergent, Insurgent, and Allegiant, I think, are both are chronological, the chronological order and the order in which they appear on the list. Divergent 3, Insurgent is 4, okay. And Allegiant is 6.
So
altogether, 1.4, 1.3 plus 1.1, 2.7. So about 3.8 million copies.
So pretty close in total as a series to what The Fault in Our Stars did by itself.
Right,
okay.
It's clustered more towards the middle. The number two selling book of the year, The Long Haul by Jeff Kinney.
Oh, okay. The Diary of a Wimpy Kid guy.
1.5 million-ish. Bill O'Reilly's book, the lone nonfiction title is Bill O'Reilly's Killing Patton. This is also the lone 2014 title.
Do you know if they're making a made-for-TV movie of that one? I know they did one for Kennedy.
I would assume so. Yeah, just short of 1.2 million. Gone Girl, as I said, number 7. And number 10, rounding out the number 10, is a middle grade novelization of Frozen.
Oh, I remember
from Disney. 785,000 copies.
When we did the halftime show sometime this summer, we saw that Frozen tie-in as well. So the story here is get your books adapted to movies. And then keep selling books.
Yes, because all of them.
Except for the Jeff Kinney, right?
Well, but he's had a movie already. So, I mean, that's an asterisk by that.
Right.
You know, it's the dog wags the tail of movies when it comes to top 10 print bestsellers, at least. Let's see.
That's interesting. I want to go to
Kindle. Kindle bestsellers, all categories, okay. All genres. So nonfiction, YA.
Nonfiction.
I don't have numbers here because of Amazon. So they can't capture it.
Yeah, they don't have the numbers.
They just pulled this from Amazon. Okay. Source Amazon. They just looked at their list.
So I wonder if that 80% at the top means
they can't do it.
80% is what BookScan has, whatever percentage BookScan has, plus whatever percentage they know Amazon has. I don't know.
We're gonna need someone from Vox to do an explainer for us.
I think the Kindle ones are pretty close, but not identical.
You're on the right track. Yeah.
I'm gonna put John Green and Gillian Flynn and all the Veronica Roths on the list.
You're right.
Not the children's stuff doesn't typically do the same, so
also,
I would kick out.
Excellent work, Shinsky. It's off.
Thank you. I'm going to kick out Jeff Kinney and kick out Frozen.
Very nicely done.
I think I'm also going to kick out Bill O'Reilly.
Very well done.
All right, so those are my eliminations.
Yeah, I don't think you've missed anything. The Kinney's gone. The O'Reilly's gone. Oh, and also, I don't know. It doesn't say because it gives it. Fault in Our Stars is number one, but it doesn't break it out by movie tie-in or hardcover.
I see.
And in the Kindle list, it just says Fault in Our Stars. There's no parenthetical, so I don't know. I guess there's only one Kindle edition.
Yes.
Right. Okay,
right.
That makes sense.
Because covers don't matter.
The covers don't matter. Or they do matter. Who knows? But okay, there's a bunch. So you basically have five get kicked out, and you have five new ones. Gone Girl bumps up to 2.
Okay.
Divergent bumps up to 3. Mm-hmm. And our first title we haven't seen before pops in at 4.
Is it based? Is there a movie for it?
There is not.
Okay. When was it published?
It was not in 2014.
It was
adult
not published
novel.
In 2014. And not in 2014, yeah. Adult novel. Was it 2013 or is it older than that and getting a bump?
Nope, it's 2013. You can see my battleship. I've given you enough coordinates to get a good guess here.
Now I'm just trying to remember.
What was the best-selling novel of last year?
Oh, The Goldfinch.
There it is right there. Okay. Beautifully done. The Goldfinch, again, we don't have numbers. And then we have Insurgent Allegiant. Mm-hmm. And then this is where it gets really interesting. 7, 8, and 9 are all new titles to us that were in our discussion here.
Okay.
We've got one YA and one nonfiction and 2 adult novels.
Oh.
These are tough.
Man, I don't know what to even ask.
For the nonfiction, remember rule number one, look to the movies.
For the nonfiction?
For the nonfiction.
Something about Alan Turing, maybe?
No, Unbroken, Laura Hill and Brad.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. I was going to guess Stephen Hawking next.
Yeah,
so
that's
I was
not
way
bad.
Off.
That's not bad. The other three, I've got no good guides for you.
Oh.
Do you want to try? All ladies? Well,
genre does really well on Kindle, so yeah. Is one of them romance?
You know, some of them I'm not even sure. Let me just tell you. One, okay. If I Stay by Gail Forman is 8.
Oh, that's YA.
YA.
Uh-huh. And there's the a movie two, of that. There's a movie of that.
Okay,
one.
Great. And then the other two are The Husband's Secret by Leanne Moriarty. And then number 9 is Orphan Train by Christina Baker Klein. Oh. Do you know those? I don't know them.
I've heard of The Husband's Secret because I think Leanne Moriarty had another book out
this year that I was looking at.
But I don't know what it's about.
So Orphan Train by Christina Baker Klein, and that's from Morrow.
Is that? I don't know anything about that.
So I will have to maybe look at that off the...
It's either a super sad nonfiction story or a super sad fiction story is my guess based on the title.
Also, now we'll transition there, and maybe this will be our last, the adult fiction top 20 in print.
Adult fiction in print.
Gone Girl 1.
Okay.
Orphan Train 3.
Okay, so it's
Christina
fiction.
Baker Klein. Yeah, it's fiction. 500,000 print copies. So that book sold big. Because Gone Girl, the trade paper of Gone Girl sold just shy of 1 million copies.
Where were we on the Orphan Train? How do we know?
I think that's commercial fiction. A blind spot for me, must admit. Yeah. But that's,
if only this were a year for Dan Brown, we'd be right about all the numbers.
Hold on to your horses, because the Inferno clock's in at number 11.
Really? Good job, Dee Brizzle.
Just below 50 Shades, the Inferno sold 322,000.
Show me print. Stephen King with no whammies.
There you go. This is good. Show me Stephen King. Mr. Mercedes clocked in at 308, number 13.
That was the big one this year, right?
Yeah. The lit breakout hit of 2014. All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr snuck in at number 20 with just shy of 250,000 in sales, which is damn fine for us.
Station 11.
Doesn't make the cut.
Really?
Doesn't make the cut.
Okay. I'm surprised by that.
The Goldfinch. Oh, we've got Gone Girl at 4 and 6, mass market and movie tie-in.
All right.
John Grisham is number 2 with Grey Mountain at 619,000. Mm-hmm. Goldfinch, number 5, just short of 500,000. So it continues to sell very
well.
Good
job, Donna Tartt.
Let's see. 50 Shades, I said, number 10.
Mm-hmm.
The Invention of Wings by Sumunk Kidd did very well this year, 300,000. That came out the first week of January last year, I remember.
Didn't that get the Oprah bump?
It did.
Okay.
Oprah bump. Mr. Mercedes, I said. Shadow Spell by Nora Roberts is on here, 300,000.
All right. That's
the Edge of
surprising.
Eternity, the new Ken Follett. Or not? Is it new? Maybe, I can't remember. 300,000. The Best of Me, the Nicholas Sparks movie tie-in.
Okay.
287. Never Go Back by Lee Child, 281. Number 18, Hope to Die by James Patterson. Number 19, 277. There are two books on here that are more than 50 years old on the top 20 fiction bestsellers.
Okay,
adult fiction.
Functionally classics.
Yeah.
Okay, well, one of them has to be To Kill a Mockingbird.
There it is.
Book
number
sells
7.
4 bajillion copies
still
a year.
Still selling
every year.
383,000 copies.
Good grief.
In the year.
Good job, Harper Lee.
Man, oh man. Wow.
You ever wonder, like, if Harper Lee could have hopped into a time machine 50 years ago and they could put her here and be like, 50 years from now,
your
you're still going to be
still selling.
You're
still selling 384,000 copies a year. I wonder where that money go. Like, what's she doing? Anyway, that's just, you know.
She's Scrooge McDucking on it,
I
obviously.
I guess. Very interesting. And so one more.
One more classic.
Classic.
Dickens? Something Dickens?
That's tough because a lot of those are in the public domain, so they're free.
Oh,
and so they don't, so it
right.
can be in
okay.
public domain. That's another.
So it's not so old that it's public domain.
So it has to be like after 1923 in America.
I'm going to go with either Hemingway or Fitzgerald.
There you go, The Great Gatsby, number 16.
Ah, the movies again, okay.
That was 2013, but it still sells through, but I'm sure there was a long tail.
Did that come out at the end of 2013? It came out in the summer, didn't it?
Yeah,
okay, so well, yeah, long tail, I guess. I remember Liberty Hardy at River Run Bookstore, who writes for us, telling me that like not a day went by for like a year that someone didn't come into the store asking for The Great Gatsby.
And that still sells 283 million. 283. That would be a record. 283,000.
Okay, still.
We can be done with the list. One thing I do want to point out that's interesting from the YA list, which is dominated by Green and Roth, the number the number, let's see, the number three, no, wait, let me look, make sure I get this right. Right. The number five best-selling adult novel would not make the YA top 20. Because number 20 on the YA top 20 print is a Frozen tie-in. Mm-hmm. Number 19 is a Frozen tie-in. They both sold about a half million. Paper Towns by John Green sold 577 last year.
Aren't they filming the movie of that right now?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Hard Luck by Jeff Kinney, 17 at 598. Another Frozen tie-in at 16. So that's 603,000. So you would just squeak in to the top 20. Four by Veronica Roth. That's her like spin-off novella about the Divergent series is 15. We have Minecraft, two Minecraft books, another Frozen book, The Maze Runner, another John Green book in the top 10, Looking for Alaska.
Which was his first book. That was like 10 years
old. Yeah, 738, 10 years old this year. Another Frozen book, If I Stay by Gail Forman. We mentioned that before. It sold 747,000 copies. A huge hit movie.
That is huge.
And then the rest is Veronica Roth and John Green until we get Jeff Kinney.
Well, I mean, young adult is keeping publishing afloat.
It's just remarkable. How many books are sold?
The kids are all right.
I don't know. And
maybe, all the adults that are reading young adult fiction are also
these two Minecraft handbooks, they're young adult?
Minecraft is, I mean,
it's a huge, it's a video game, but why is it young adult?
Well, it seems to me, I think they just chunk that in with kids and young adult under the assumption.
I guess it's juvenile that's video games.
You know, the assumption that most of the users, and I guess Minecraft has data, maybe, about, oh, and they're published by Scholastic.
Yeah, so I understand how it's sort of categorized here, but video games aren't necessarily anymore.
Right. Yeah, juvenile. The content's not necessarily for kids or young adults because anybody can play Minecraft, and I would assume that the demographics span age and gender and all sorts of categories.
I mean, really, the books that we've talked about, especially was it two shows ago, we did our favorites or it books. I can't remember what order it was, but none of these we talked about, right? Do we talk about any of these books? Not one, I don't think.
I don't think so.
Which, you know, I don't know what that means.
We're old?
Well, I don't. Do you think Bill O'Reilly's audience is younger than ours or Stephen King's?
No, that's true.
I mean, I guess
30-something internet professionals.
Well, we're book nerds, right?
Yeah, that too.
That's not. These aren't book nerd lists. This is what the mass market. This is what the big selling books are.
Well, Bill O'Reilly, that's a great example of what having a giant TV audience will do for your book sales. It's in the same way that like Rush Limbaugh was. I remember seeing a headline that he was the author of one of the best-selling children's books of last year. Mm-hmm. You know, Oprah drove sales by recommending books that other people
wrote.
And
his own imprint and own distribution networks and just the whole, you know, own all the way down. So I don't know. I mean,
it's interesting.
That's what the people are reading. Mm-hmm. And I think we're not the people when it comes to books. That's not, you know, we don't cover the biggest selling books. We cover what we like, and we've read some of these. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I guess that's a good question. How many of I've read The Goldfinch, I've read all the Roth, and I've read Fault in Our Stars.
I'm clicking on the thing now so I can look at the list. I read The Fault in Our Stars. I read Gone Girl. I've seen Frozen.
That probably counts.
Does that count? I read The Goldfinch.
Well, if you read Fault in Our Stars and the Roth trilogy, which I have, that gives me 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I've not read the Roth trilogy, so I've got 1, 2. Yeah. I've read two of those top 10 print, and then I also read The Goldfinch. Mm-hmm. Which gives me 3 of the top 10 Kindle bestsellers.
I've read much more of the Kindle bestsellers. Fault in Our Stars, Gone Girl, the Roth, Goldfinch. Yeah. And I want to read it. Did you ever read Unbroken?
Yeah, I have the audiobook of it right now. I haven't started it yet.
That's a no, by the way.
That's a no.
Yes, okay. I don't know why that was important for me to say.
Did you read it? Do you want your cookie?
No, I just want to know if it's good. I mean, I'm sure it's good. I mean, the billion plus people have read it. Because when did that come out?
Couple
it's been
years
several
back.
Years. I mean, yeah, let's get a movie bump
I think it was like 2012.
Yeah. She's interesting. There's a nice long profile of her in the Times. Did
there
you read
was.
That?
She. I read most of the profile. Not all of it, since we're now calculating.
Yeah, sort of pedantically accurate. I don't know where that came from. I apologize about
If you'll hold on, I'll send you my reading spreadsheet at the end of the
show. And you're going to need to give me daily updates about which page you are on. I'm going to need to check this.
You know what's interesting is Wild didn't, to me.
Well, that's where I was going to go next in terms of surprises. That I thought Wild might, I mean, I guess it's, the problem there is it's nonfiction, right?
Right. And but so is Unbroken.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I'm just saying that, like, Unbroken has broken through to a mat. Like, it's on the table at Costco and has been for, like, 2 years.
Yeah, but Cheryl Strayed was on Oprah, and there's a movie with Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, like, to crack the nonfiction list, you've got to sell so, like, that's the
true.
Other thing. The nonfiction list, to be on it, you've got to do at least 260, which was Hard Choices, did 260. Oh, Wild clocked in number 13 on the nonfiction list.
Okay, and that's good.
337. So it's in the mix. It's in the mix. We didn't talk about the nonfiction list. Oh, God. Heaven is for real. A couple of them.
Oh, now I'm looking at it. Yay, Amy Poehler. That's happy. She's at 15.
15. You know what's not on here?
What?
It got a huge advance. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, Lena Dunham.
Not that kind of girl. Not on here.
Interesting.
Also, huge advance, BJ Novak's One More Thing came out in 2014. Mm-hmm. Nowhere to be seen.
Not on the fiction list. You know, not super surprising that a book of short stories and basically essays doesn't make the...
Yes.
I'd be significantly more surprised if it did, but you're right.
It got a huge advance, right? It didn't? Was the Kaling new this year?
No, Mindy Kaling was a couple
last
years ago.
Year. Okay.
2013, right. I think. So interesting on this nonfiction list is What If by Randall Monroe.
Yes, which came out late last year, by the way.
He's the guy behind XKCD, and which, you know, webcomic. And they sent me a copy because they were sponsoring some stuff on the website. But it's great.
It's a lot of
fun. He takes, like, absurd questions that people have about physics and science and then comes up with the actual ridiculous but logical answers to them. It's wonderful.
I was browsing around. I don't remember what I was doing, but I ended up on Amazon's bestseller list for print at the end of last – it was in December. And that was number three for that week. So I think that's one that you're going to see some 2015 sell-through.
And they're doing a lot of advertising for it, it looks like.
Yeah, well, they spent some with us, it has to be said.
Number 11 on the nonfiction list is The Five Love Languages.
Oh, we talked about... Did we talk about this on the show or offline? I can't remember.
We must have talked about it offline.
Yeah,
but,
must
like,
have.
That book's been out forever.
It got someone linked to it or something, because it's burbled up, and this is where you care about gifts and I care about time or whatever. That's the thing.
Yeah, and I wonder if... I wonder if it's just always on the list. Like, I don't remember looking at
maybe
these lists
it is.
Last year, but it was, I mean, I think I was a kid when it came out because I can remember, like, people at the church I grew up in reading it in some kind of book club or there being something about, like, you know, understanding people's love languages and then, right, and it's, you know, like, this person expresses love and receives love by getting gifts and this other person expresses love and receives love by physical affection or by verbal, you know, shows of appreciation, and it's supposed to help you understand how your partner works or how your friend works. And they've adapted it like The Five Languages of the Workplace.
Oh, they chicken souped it.
Yeah, they chicken souped the crap out of it. There are so many spinoffs.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I bet it just sits there. Like,
must just sit there.
People sort of understand in the culture, or maybe it's like my nerdy circle of the culture, like what you're referring to when you're like, oh, well, Amanda jokes that my spiritual gift is making roast chickens, but like it might actually be my love language. It's like,
no, roast
I care
chickens.
For you and I made you this chicken.
Your universally acceptable currency is
exactly.
Poultry.
It's, yeah. Right. It's a roasted poultry.
Okay. So I think that's kind of it.
We jumped way down the stats
hole. I haven't mentioned
a
person of color. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, there's... No, I'm looking now to see if there's even...
Can't find one that I know of. Some of these authors I don't know. Like, it could be, for all I know, that... what's her name? Who wrote The Orphan Train? Whatever. Christine something. Is... isn't
right. I don't...
But,
right. Publishing doesn't have a diversity problem,
we
Jeff.
We have more people named Brown than are Brown on this list. Daniel Brown for Boys in the Boat and Dan Brown for The Inferno. So, I mean, there's that. You don't love, I don't think, the weakness of the new... We sort of talked about this in the last show, that there wasn't really a breakout novel hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the big books that people in our circles, you know, Bad Feminist, you've mentioned Station 11, The Martian, like even things we know a lot of people read. We need to... you know, someday when we're rich and famous, we're going to get a book scan subscription because we got to know these things. This is infuriating.
And it's so expensive.
It's like $3,000 a year. We've talked about this before. That's like, it might as well be, we might as well buy ourselves Ferraris. I'd rather have a book scan subscription than a Ferrari.
They should sponsor the show and give us free access.
Now you're talking. That is what I like to hear right there. Because I want to know how much The Martian sold. Was it like 50,000? And I'm just, or Untamed State or The Station 11? Right. I mean, these are the books that we talked about.
Fall into BookScan and never come
out. It's probably, we've said this before, it's probably good we don't have it.
Probably so.
Because we'd have to do like a 12-part standalone podcast on just like BookScan numbers.
If we
wants to hear.
We would have the Methodology Corner spin-off. You know, wouldn't be the worst thing.
Okay. Well, that's probably enough of that.
Yeah, that's plenty enough.
We jumped way
down that one. I'm interested in what that list is going to look like at the end of 2015 because we do have the Franzen and the Toni Morrison. And there's a new
Ishiguro.
Right, and a new Margaret Atwood.
But are these just our book? I mean, those are going to even have a chance.
Jonathan Franzen tends to be breakout.
Be interesting to see.
Big fiction sales on the level of like a Donna Tartt big fiction.
So $500,000 to a million in sales.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
Where do you want to go next?
I don't know. There's a
lot
to
do. There's so many things.
I don't want to do. We have overdrive usage stats. Maybe we'll save that for next week. Mm-hmm. I guess.
Let's save the Bitlet stats, too.
Do you want to save that? Okay. I was going to go there next, but that's okay.
Well, yeah, no, we can go there.
It's pretty quick.
Oh, right. I'll be out next week. So let's talk about the things.
There's some stuff that Amanda will be on with me next week, and there's some good stuff. You're more interested in this than she is, maybe.
Yeah, let's do numbers, man.
So this is BitLit. They gave us some numbers about their readership. And there were three bullet points, all of which I thought were really interesting. Mm-hmm. They 12 mentions, they launched the app, and they've got three main takeaways.
And maybe for the people who don't know what BitLit
is, if they haven't heard us
talk about it, it's an app / service where they provide bundling of ebooks for the print books that you – there's stuff flying off my desk now. I'm so excited. Mm-hmm. For the stuff that you already own. So you take a picture of your signature on the title page of a book, and if they have that book in their library because they got like licensing from the publisher, they'll send you a free or discounted edition of that ebook. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of stuff there.
So they have three bullet takeaways. I thought all of them were interesting. Readers like the idea of retroactive bundling over point of purchase. So that means once they've already bought the print book, they come back later rather than at the time of buying the book.
Interesting.
And are more likely to bundle a backlist book than a frontlist one. I've got caveats to all these, but I'm just going to get the bullet points out first.
Okay.
So that means something that's been out for, I don't even know, frontlist is, when does a frontlist technically end?
When the paperback comes out.
Is that right? Okay.
That's my definition.
But if it's only a paperback?
Then like a year later.
Okay. So that's the general parameter.
Yeah.
1 in 7 people will pay an extra 20% of the digital list price in addition to the print price in order to receive both formats. Hmm. Okay.
One in seven
will pay an extra 20%.
I have questions too, but let's get these bullets out.
And 3, while men and women are equally interested in bundling, men are 2 times more likely to pay for a bundled ebook, while women prefer to get their content for free.
Huh.
Very interesting all along. So caveats to the whole thing, and then maybe individually, is BitLit's new, and as a new tech thing, we're in early adopter stage. Mm-hmm. So early adopters do different things differently than the mass market. So if this ever gets to be a big deal, I'd imagine these numbers will change. Who knows in what direction? Second, BitLit has done a great job. I think it's a nice service. They don't have a lot of mainstream books on there. A lot of small presses, independent presses. I don't know they have any big five publishers. I don't know. I don't think that they do.
And do we know how many users they have? I mean, we're assuming that it's relatively small because they're new.
It doesn't say. I shouldn't say they don't have any. They don't have major, like, hundreds of title support for a major publisher. Because I know, for example, Nosferatu by Joe Hill was available. Mm-hmm. I think he went out of his way to make that happen.
Yeah.
This is also a certain kind of title spread that's not indicative of the larger book market.
I'm wondering about that specifically with the first bullet point that talks about readers liking the idea of retroactive bundling.
Right. How many frontlists are even available now?
Right, and preferring backlist over frontlist. Like, if the frontlist that they've got is frontlist, but it's from unknown publishers or unknown authors, then but their backlist availability is some bigger titles, then of course people are more likely to go for the backlist. And like, does like the idea of it mean that you ask them that and they like it? Or does like the idea of it mean that they've bundled more from the backlist? Yeah. Like,
tricky.
It's so many questions. Confounding factors.
Right. So 20%, an extra 20% of the digital list price in addition to the print price in order to receive both formats. That's a little confusing.
Yeah, like one in seven people will pay that. And so
six in seven won't is maybe the more interesting stat yeah, but for what's, me.
Like, I guess I want to know what the question was.
Right.
Like, or what like was
or
it?
Or maybe it's not a question. Maybe it's just behavior, like what people actually did.
Yeah. Mm. What if it were 10%? What if it were 30% extra?
The men and women thing is interesting, though I don't know what to make of it necessarily. Men are two times more likely to pay for a bundled ebook, while women prefer to get their mm-hmm. content for free.
And
I don't know why you need that while. Just
when it
period.
Says, like, men and women are equally interested in bundling. Does that just mean that BitLit has an equal number of men and women users?
Yeah, because it doesn't say they don't say they bundle equally. They're just interested in equally.
Yeah.
Which I don't know what the
men
parameter
are two times more likely to pay for a bundled ebook. Women prefer to get their content for free. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's all interesting. We didn't know any of that. I mean, we're getting some stats about bundling, and you and I are both interested in that. So.
Yes.
All right.
More context would be delightful, but I'm interested.
Do we need to?
We should probably do our next sponsor.
I was going to say, we're already 45 minutes into the show. We better do another sponsor.
Our next sponsor for this show is Near Enemy by Adam Sternberg. It's the second book in his Spademan series. The first one is Shovel Ready. These are set in a future New York. This is kind of dystopian speculative fiction. Spademan before the end of things, which was a dirty bomb that decimated several years ago. Before that, he was a garbage man, and now he is a hitman who works mostly by killing people with a box cutter, but also carries a gun, you know, like usual. And in this future New York, the people who are wealthy enough to do it stay inside in their well-protected, like fortress-y homes, and they tap in to a complex virtual reality system that's run by like drugging yourself and then tapping into this other other realm, basically, that's all virtual reality. And the people who can't afford that, like Spademan, are struggling on the streets to survive. In the first book, he's hired to go after the daughter of an unsavory and very popular evangelist that when I read it, I pictured as like an evil younger Pat Robertson. And in the new book, he is out to snuff a guy who taps in and lurks in other people's fantasies. Mm. I think these are so fun. The voice is really hard-boiled. Lauren Bucus, who wrote Broken Monsters and The Shining Girls, called the books sharp as a paper cut. This future New York is gritty. The characters are fun to be around. I just thought there was, you know, some swagger in the voice. Spademan is an interesting character that sort of feels familiar in that gritty, hard-boiled hitman story way, but also wholly new. Mm. I think these are a lot of fun. So I'm glad to have them sponsoring the show. I really enjoyed the books. Again, the first one was Shovel Ready. Near Enemy is the second book. It has just come out, so it's available wherever books are sold. It's a nice genre mashup. And if Sternberg's name sounds familiar to you, it's because he's a writer for New York Magazine. He's active on Twitter.
Good writer.
Yeah.
He's a good writer.
At Sternberg, Sternberg. And you can also watch Book Riot for an exclusive new short story about Spademan that he is writing.
Cool.
For us.
Great. Check that out.
Yeah, so thanks to them for sponsoring the show.
You want to tell me about some new books?
Oh, already new books,
I
huh?
know. Yeah, I think so, man.
We're going so fast.
Well, we're 50 minutes in. What do you want me to do? You want to talk about something else?
I want to talk about Kareem
Abdul-Jabbar.
Okay,
all right, let's do that.
I am not going to rest until we talk about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
All right.
Our agenda for this show is super long, and there were
tons. We've got to nothing.
Right, we did get to nothing. We got lost in the swamp of stats and mm-hmm. the rodents of unusual size. But there were a ton of little interesting stories this week, and so I'm not going to discuss it, but Idris Elba is developing a thriller trilogy of movies about Edgar Allan Poe, which I'm very excited about. But I am even more excited about the fact that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has written a Mycroft Holmes novel, which is who is Sherlock Holmes's brother. So basically, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has written Sherlock Holmes fan fiction, and it is getting published.
Yeah, by Titan Books in the fall.
By a real publisher. Yeah,
he's an interesting guy, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
He is such a smart and like,
he's written several other books. I saw him on Celebrity Jeopardy. He was awesome on that. Very, very interesting guy. When there was the latest flare-up of like YA is bad for us, he wrote a really nice response.
Thoughtful writer.
For a California newspaper, which one escapes me in the moment.
You don't write a book about Mycroft Holmes because you're not a book nerd.
No, not at all. And I mean, it is a little bit surprising that he's doing this particular. He's written other books before. So I think if you had given me a draft of, you said, an athlete is writing a Sherlock Holmes fan fiction novel. Who is it? I might have picked Kareem One.
Really?
Well, who? I mean, he's. Again, I follow basketball.
I was going to say, I don't know who else I would pick.
So I don't know who else it would be, but he definitely is, you know, one of the more book nerdy of the sort of all-time great living professional athletes.
I think this is fun and surprising in the way that the Murakami advice column is fun and surprising.
Yes, I'm going to read this.
That we talked about last week. I'm totally going to read this.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. And Mycroft is also super interesting as well.
This just makes character. This is one of those moments that I was like, oh, I love publishing and I love book nerds and just people who are unapologetically into the thing they're into. Because you know this begins with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar like reading a whole lot of Sherlock Holmes and like maybe kicking back and watching Cumberbatch on Netflix and being like, you know, what about Mycroft?
Yeah, he actually, it says in here that he became interested in Sherlock Holmes, reading Sherlock Holmes during his rookie year as a player. Which would have been, I think, in the mid to late 60s, if my timeline is right. And that later he read something called Enter the Lion, a posthumous memoir of Mycroft Holmes, which I think is nonfiction. And so ever since then, he's been interested in the character, the older, smarter kind of person in the government. So, I mean, that's a very interesting story.
Stoked. I am so stoked. Good job, Kareem.
Good job, Kareem. So that's coming this fall.
I just think that's so much fun. Okay, new books.
New books. All right. Are you all right? Are we ready?
Ready. All right. I mean, it's fine.
All right.
It wasn't quite as crazy of a week for book releases this time around as it was last week. We're just kind of solidly in January. First big release, and it is getting lots of buzz. The folks at Riverhead are working hard on this one, is The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, which I read over the weekend. Really interesting. It's rotating chapters from three female narrators. The primary one is named Rachel. She is an alcoholic who has lost her job and one night takes the train. She lives near London and she takes the train to the little village where her ex-husband lives with his new wife and finds herself the witness, she thinks, or somehow involved in the disappearance of another woman who lives in that town, that every day Rachel is taking the train from her normal city into London. And as the train stops by this little town, she sees this woman and her husband like every day standing out on their deck. And they look perfect and happy. And she imagines what their names are and she imagines their lives and sort of, you know, is a little bit minorly obsessed with them. And when the woman disappears, Rachel realizes that in one of her drunken stupors, she has taken the train to town to see the ex-husband and might have been somehow involved in this other woman's disappearance. We also get chapters from the disappeared woman's voice and from a third woman who is involved in the story. There are lots of twists and turns, lots of good, unreliable narrator stuff because Rachel, in her alcoholic stupors, doesn't remember things. She blacks out and then tries to put the pieces together of what has happened. And it was a really compelling read. It was a page turner, good tension. And I enjoyed it. So if you're looking for a good thriller on a, you know, suspenseful thriller type story on a Sunday afternoon, I say go for it. The other big one of the week is The Unquiet Dead by Ozma Zehanat Khan, and Amanda really liked this one. Mm. I have not read it yet, but also it's kind of a mystery detective story. But it's Detective Rachel Getty, who trusts her boss implicitly, but she is uneasy at the tight-lipped secrecy when her boss asks her to look into the death of someone named Christopher Drayton. He apparently had an accidental fall from a cliff that the police don't seem to think warrants investigation. But she learns that he may have actually been living under an assumed name, and she begins to understand why the people who are investigating are actually tiptoeing around the case. And it comes to light that Christopher Drayton might have been a war criminal with ties to the Srebrenica massacre of 1995, which I don't know what that is.
And it doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good. No. But actual historical things. So you've got a new suspense thriller set in the moment of a real historical event. Amanda said, I think on Twitter, that she had not heard of this either, but learned a whole lot about that moment in history while reading the book, but also just thought the story was really fantastic. And I trust Amanda's spidey senses. So this one's on my list now. Again, it's called The Unquiet Dead, and it's a debut novel. So those are the two biggies.
I've got one more. Can I have one more?
Of course. Haven't read it. I guess so.
I don't usually chime in, but this one, I don't know why I like this sort of, I like science-y nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And this one is called The Neutrino Hunters, The Thrilling Chase for a Ghostly Particle to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe by Ray, J. Hawardadana. I'm just going to take a shot.
That sounds really interesting.
It's about an 80-year quest of scientists around the globe to look for one of these small elements of matter called neutrinos. Like trillions, literally trillions of them pass through your body every second. That's how small they are.
Oh, wow.
And it's about antimatter and science and funding. And I'm really in, you know, a giant Olympic-sized pool deep underground and ice just to get a couple of them to trap. You know, like it's all this weird stuff you have to do when you're at the outer limit of scientific inquiry. So anyway, and I also like sort of the ineluctable pieces of science. It's either of the very small or the very large of astrophysics and particle physics. So
I want to watch a late night Science Channel documentary about that.
I don't know if it's on audiobook. It's from Scientific American, so I'm going to check it out. If it is, I'm listening to that one. But that's one that
great.
I was super excited to look at. So,
yeah, that sounds awesome. The one thing I forgot to mention in the show that we didn't get to for stats that I think we should just mention is that Kickstarter put out their stats last year. Publishing Projects raised $22 million on Kickstarter, making it one of the top three categories for all Kickstarter projects last year.
Which I think is remarkable.
Yeah.
I don't know about the number, but where it ranks.
Yeah, that of all the different kinds of things people are doing on Kickstarter, book-related stuff is in the top three that people support.
And the first two, I think, are like hardware and design or something. Yeah. I can't remember what it was.
A little more techie.
Yeah, yeah. And more expensive, frankly, to like you have to build like a lamp or some digital device takes a lot more money. So I'm guessing there were also a lot more smaller campaigns for publishing.
That's true.
Rather than, you know, a couple that did whole bunch.
I would guess that $22 million was spread out over a bunch of small campaigns rather than just a handful of big successful ones. But then again, there was the like $6 million.
Oh, Reading Rainbow.
Reading Rainbow one. And
We Need Diverse Books,
had a really big campaign.
Something like
so
that,
you know, those two.
Maybe that's right. Maybe you're right.
Those
Maybe
were big players.
That.
We better just call that a show before I keep shoehorning extra things.
Yeah, I know. We'll call that a show. As always, you can find show notes for this show, all the articles we talked about, bookriot.com/podcast. If you have feedback for the show, questions, comments, things you'd like us to talk about, whatever, you can email us at podcast@bookriot.com. Go check out the page for information about Book Riot Live. It's going to have 1,500 attendees, a two-day event, November 7th and 8th, here in New York City in Manhattan at the Metropolitan West. The first round of discounted tickets will go on sale in about a month or so. And you can sign up for the email, so you get the email right away, so you can jump on one of those cheap tickets if you want one. bookriot.com/category/podcast. We're going to clean up that URL so it's easier to remember
in
the future.
Or is it /Book Riot Live?
I don't think that goes anywhere.
Oh, no? Okay, I don't think never mind. Yeah. I'm making it up.
Yeah, and then you can get to me on Twitter at the Jeff O'Neill, O-N-E-L. You can get to her on Twitter at Rebecca Shinsky, S-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y. Or you can always find us haunting the Book Riot Twitter account, which is at Book Riot. And I think that's our show. Thanks so much to Near Enemy by Adam Sternberg and Squarespace for sponsoring the show. Amanda will be back with me next week. You'll be on vacation.
I will be.
Have a wonderful vacation hunting for neutrinos up in Antarctica. I wish you all the best for finding one.
Up in Antarctica?
That's the part you're objecting to, not that you're going to be hunting for neutrinos?
I think hunting for neutrinos sounds like a fine way to spend a vacation.
Well, which way are you facing right now? Is it then that means that's how you can tell if it's up or down?
Oh, Jeff.
All right, we'll talk to you guys next week.
Have a good one.